I'm Tom Hall. Welcome to Midday. Today, it's Midday on Ethics. Gene editing is in the news again. Scientists talk about the benefits of permanently altering the genes of plants or animals, but what happens next? What about the possible unintended consequences when future generations, including humans, inherit altered genes? Plus, the gene therapies that give hope to some cancer patients can cost $1 million or more. And that raises all sorts of ethical questions about access and fairness. Dr. Jeffrey Kahn, the director of the Johns Hopkins Berman Institute of Bioethics, joins me to explore the ethical questions behind the headlines. Midday on Ethics gets underway right after the news. Good afternoon, everybody. I'm Tom Hall. Very glad you're with us today for Midday. Today, it's another edition of Midday on Ethics. We've talked several times over the past year about gene editing and the ethical questions that go along with potentially editing the genes of plants and animals, including humans. And so today, a follow-up on the latest developments in this controversial field. Dr. Jeffrey Kahn, the director of the Johns Hopkins Berman Institute of Bioethics, is here. You know, it appears that folks are beginning to think about CRISPR technology in new ways. This technology is only about 4 or 5 years old. It allows scientists to edit genes precisely to do things potentially like reduce the risk of passing along an inherited disease or eliminate the risk altogether. So we could, for example, eliminate the mosquitoes that carry malaria. About a year and a half ago, a couple of scientists proposed what to many people seemed like a good idea at that time, using CRISPR to save animals who faced extinction because they were threatened by an invasive species. So the idea was to implant a so-called gene drive, a gene that would reduce the fertility of the invasive animals, thus giving the endangered species in the same area a better chance at survival. Well, a couple weeks ago, the news caught our eye that the very scientists who had proposed this idea originally now says that field testing it would be a bad idea. So why is that? What are the unintended consequences of gene editing, including human gene editing? Dr. Jeff Kahn stops by from time to time to help us explore these kinds of questions and frame them as complicated as they are. Jeff, it's good to see you.
Good to be here. Thank you.
And we welcome your questions and comments in the Twittersphere, on email, or on the phone. 410-662-8780, our email, midday@wipr.org, and to find us on Twitter @MiddayTomHall. So we have talked about this CRISPR thing before. When you look at it on the page, CRISPR, it looks like one of those Twitter abbreviations. But recap for us what this technology does.
Yeah, so CRISPR is an acronym, and it's probably not worth going into what it stands for, because that's molecular biology and biochemistry. But it's a tool that will allow very precise and controlled editing of genes. So it offers the ability to snip out and presumably insert and correct in the genome of anything that's got DNA, so that's every living thing, in ways that can either fix, so when we talk about disease in humans, fix a genetic defect or a genetic mutation, or as you described in the intro, maybe introduce a gene that isn't so much repairing something that's a mutation, but rather serves a purpose that may otherwise not be in nature, but that has been created through man's intervention in the environment. So things like invasive species, as you mentioned.
Is it like a machine? I mean, is there like at Hopkins, you know, the CRISPR machine, and you put stuff in it, you put cells in it? I mean, how does it actually work physically?
So we're going to get quickly into an area where I don't have great expertise. I should maybe remind everyone that I studied molecular biology in college, but that's a very long time ago, and so the science has really surpassed anything I ever studied. But I follow this from the work that I do around ethics and policy. So it's really biochemical combinations, and so you can use the CRISPR-Cas9 is the full name, tools to identify an area of DNA where the editing will actually happen, the snipping, the cutting will happen. So it's actually taking a base pair combination, making a cassette out of it so that it goes to the right place in the cell that you want to alter, and then allowing that alteration to happen biochemically. So it's just a very precise way of doing a genetic modification.
Mm-hmm. And allow me to ask you a few more dumb questions about this. So you can take stuff out of a genetic code or a genetic sequence if the stuff is bad, right? Got that. And sometimes just taking it out is going to fix the problem, mm-hmm. right? So you can also put stuff in. You can put genes into an existing genetic code. Where do those genes come from? Can you take genes from some other place? Could I take a gene from me and put it into you, or vice versa?
Well, it's just biochemistry, really. So it's synthesized. So it's not that difficult in a laboratory to just make the base pair order that you desire. And then that is put into the cassette, and that's inserted. So it doesn't have to come from another organism. It's just made out by like a chemistry set. Think of it that way.
Whip up your own.
Correct.
Yeah. And gene drive technology. We've heard about gene editing. And what does this term gene drive mean? Yeah,
so gene drive is effectively a way of making sure that the edit that you have introduced gets driven, hence drive, throughout the population. So the way that organisms, when they reproduce, there's a mixture that happens. Think of how we as humans or other mammals reproduce. There's male and female, so you get 50% from each parent into the offspring. Gene drive assures that the particular modification or the particular genetic combination is in every offspring from the individual that's got gene drive in it. So it will spread that modification throughout a population in a very efficient, very rapid way. It doesn't rely on the sort of 50-50% luck of the draw, as it were, when you've got genetic recombination, which is what happens in mammalian reproduction right. by mammals.
Like us. Right. So that's where one of the problems exists, because it is, the scientists refer to this as aggressive. I mean,
exactly.
You can't do this slowly.
The reason that you would do it is because it isn't slow. Right. So think of the positive example, or the example where people have really thought this could make huge strides, is in introducing a gene into mosquito populations so that they either will die, will crash that population, or modifying mosquitoes so that they can't bite humans and take a blood meal, so that they couldn't pass malaria any longer. And so by introducing
that, they would also die.
They would also die, or you can make it so that they could feed on some animals but not mm-hmm. others. Mm-hmm. Or they couldn't host the malaria parasite efficiently or effectively. So if you'd want that mutation to spread throughout the mosquito population as quickly as possible, and mosquitoes reproduce very rapidly. So if you think of how this might happen in humans or other mammals, it takes us a while to reproduce. A generation in humans is 25 years. A generation in mosquitoes is a few days. And so you would introduce that change into one individual, release that, or a few individuals, release that into an environment. They would breed, and all of their offspring would have that same modification, such that it would spread into the population very, very, very rapidly, and as you put it, aggressively. And that's a good thing if you're trying to achieve the goal of crashing a mosquito population or modifying it so that it can't infect. But in other contexts, that might be a problematic feature of gene drive. And it's a new technology. So the combination, really, of CRISPR, these gene editing tools like CRISPR, and gene drive, which allows that modification to drive into the population very efficiently and effectively, is what's creating an interesting new conversation.
And this is not a theoretical conversation.
No.
I mean, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation are spending $40 million on malaria in particular. There are 300,000 children in Africa who die from malaria every year. I mean, this is an enormous problem, and there's a whole lot of mosquitoes in that part of the world and, you know, in certain parts of Maryland at certain times of the year.
Well, right, so, and not malaria in Maryland, but there are mosquito-borne diseases in Maryland, and there certainly are many mosquito-borne diseases in the United States. So we went through Zika last year, right? It's in Florida, it's probably in Texas, it's in the warmer states. That same mosquito that carries Zika carries dengue fever, carries chikungunya. And so those are tropical diseases that we have never heard of in North America, but they are now coming into the southern United States. And so that's a different mosquito than the one that carries malaria, but if we can cure or deal with mosquitoes that carry some of these diseases, we assumedly or presumably could do the same thing in other contexts. So very powerful tools for public health purposes. But we don't know what the effects of crashing a mosquito population would be in an ecosystem. So the, part of the story here is it's one thing to do things in a controlled laboratory environment. It's another to do something in an ecosystem where we don't really have the ability to put the genie back in the bottle, as it were.
And I guess it's difficult to come up with models that might suggest what would happen. And that's one of the articles that caught our attention. There's this guy, his name is Estvelt, Dr. Estvelt, Kevin Estvelt, and he's from Harvard University originally. Now he's at MIT, and this was his idea to do stuff like this. And I guess maybe the Gates Foundation, you know, picked up on that kind of stuff, you know, picked up on the stuff that he was doing. And now he says we shouldn't really try this, because he's concerned that you can't contain it, as I understand his argument.
Yeah, so it's a kind of generalizable or generalized problem when we have these very new technologies where we can study them in very controlled laboratory environments, but there needs to be an introduction into a human, say, for the first time, and that's one person who would be affected. It's a different kind of problem, but that's a problem. Very different problem, though, than introducing something into an environment where it will spread. And so what to know, how to model before we introduce for that first time in what are being termed field trials. But it's not clear that we can do field trials where they really will be controlled of animals or mosquitoes. You worry about species getting out of the controlled area and spreading then into native, non-invasive populations.
I mean, like off the top of your head, if they introduce these mosquitoes who are essentially going to neuter all the other mosquitoes when it comes to malaria spreading. I don't know if that's a good term to use, but, you know, they're going to make it impossible to spread malaria. And you put it in this, you know, you start in Kenya or something. Pick a country in Africa, any country. You start there. And then the danger is it could just spread to every mosquito in the world, in the planet. And is that a bad thing? I mean, what's wrong if no mosquito ever again has the capacity to transmit malaria?
Maybe nothing. And there probably will be different versions of the concerns raised depending on the species and the environment. So in the mosquito case, if we crash a population by making, it's usually males that are modified, making them so that they are infertile or they mate, but the offspring have this infertility gene, and so it will effectively crash the population. So what happens in an ecosystem where the mosquito that would carry malaria is gone? Well, one thing is there are things that eat mosquitoes, bats, other creatures. And so one question is, well, what happens to the things in the ecosystem that relied on mosquitoes for food? We don't want them around for malaria, but we may want them around for the food they provide to other things in that ecosystem. It turns out there are many, many, many species of mosquitoes, some of which carry disease, some of which do not. And so maybe the answer is the ecosystem would just have more of different kinds of mosquitoes and not of the ones that carry malaria.
Yeah,
and maybe that's okay. But we don't know. We've not ever done this. Now, the truth is we kind of have randomly done this by introducing invasive species in environments where they didn't exist before. So we know what happens when a species ends up in a place it wasn't originally native. So the mosquito that carries dengue is called Aedes aegypti because it comes from Egypt. But we're talking about it being in South America, which is where the in Brazil, right, where the Zika outbreak happened last, in North America, we're not in Egypt. And so it was an invasive species here and in South America. So maybe we should say anything that's invasive, we want to, you know, tamp down because it has all these negative implications and impacts on ecosystems.
Jeff Kahn, you are fun to have around because, boy, there's a whole lot of stuff to think about. And we are going to come back in just a bit and talk more with Dr. Jeffrey Kahn. He's the director of the Johns Hopkins Berman Institute of Bioethics. We're talking about ethical questions raised by the possible unintended consequences of gene editing, particularly the editing of genes that can be inherited. So Peter and Towson, hang tight. John and Union Bridge, hang tight. We'll get to your calls as soon as we come back from a break. If you'd like to join our conversation, 410-662-8780, our email midday@wipr.org, to find us in the Twittersphere @midday. Tom Hall, it's Giving Tuesday. We are grateful to you for considering a gift to WIPR today. You can do that at wipr.org. Thanks so much for listening, and thanks so much for donating. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
This is Your Public Radio, 88.1 WIPR.
Welcome back. I'm Tom Hall. It's midday. By the way, coming up on the broadcast tomorrow, we're going to check in with a couple of members of the Baltimore City Council as they complete their first year in office, Zeke Cohen of the 1st District and John T. Bullock, who represents the 9th District, will join me here in Studio A. That's tomorrow. Coming up on midday, if you've just joined us today, my guest is Dr. Jeffrey Kahn. He's the director of the Johns Hopkins Berman Institute of Bioethics, and we're talking about the ethical questions raised by gene editing. Our phone number here at midday, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wipr.org. You can send us a tweet @midday, Tom Hall. Let's go to the phones. Peter in Towson, welcome to Midday with Dr. Kahn.
Yes, so you can hear me okay?
Yes, sir.
Okay. First of all, I really enjoy your show. But the second thing, I was just curious about the relationship between CRISPR and epigenetics. And epigenetics, apparently, they're with epigenetic markers, the genes are either expressed, allowed to be expressed, or they're inhibited. And I'm just wondering if there's a connection. Is CRISPR a form of epigenetics? And I'll get off and go ahead and take your answer off.
All right. Well, thank you for the call, Peter. I have no idea what Peter's talking about. What are epigenetics?
Yeah, that's an interesting point, Peter. So as you rightly said, epigenetics is the influence on environmental and other external factors on the expression of genes. So it's not the modification of genes, the DNA, but actually how those genes are expressed depends on what's going on in an environment. So that's as a baby is developing in utero, that environment in which it is developing will have an effect on the expression of the genes as it develops. And we all, as we do things going about our lives, the air we breathe, the food we eat, the good or bad things we put in our body have an effect on the expression of our genes and can affect our health or our illness. So it's not just about what you inherit. It's about how that inherited set of genes gets expressed, and that's epigenetics. So that's not really related to CRISPR, which is a modification of the genome part, not of the epigenetic part, but that's it's a complicated picture. And one of the lessons about epigenetics is we maybe decades ago had a very deterministic sense of how genetics influenced our health and our behavior. It's much more complicated. Yeah. And so our environmental behavioral effects have a much bigger impact on our genome than we previously understood.
All sorts of stuff we used to think were simple.
Exactly.
And they ain't simple anymore. Let's go to John in Union Bridge. John, welcome to Midday with Dr. Jeff Kahn.
Yeah. Thank you, Dr. Kahn. I'm just thinking about, you know, it's a wonderful thing to have gene therapy and to among responsible parties and to... you know, it's an adventure, really. It's a scientific breakthrough, and somehow it can be used to better our civilization. However, I wonder what what the S, how do you control a rogue party, a rogue nation or a rogue group from doing the same thing to mosquitoes or whatever to cause havoc in another population? So I'll get off the line, but I thought the ethics of that must be enormous. So.
Yeah, well, thanks for that call, John. Interesting notion of weaponizing gene drive technology and gene editing.
Yeah.
If you could kill mosquitoes, you could kill people, right?
Well, right. Or you could do all sorts of things to people. The truth is it takes people a long time to reproduce, as we've already said. So it would take much longer to create a population-level effect. But in over 100 years, certainly, you could. Over 50 years, you could have two generations worth of individuals affected. So there is lots of discussion about the foreign policy implications of these technologies, for instance. So there's actually international discussions going on, because among the features of 21st century science is that it's much more democratic than in the mid-20th century. So when the first recombinant DNA, so genetic modification tools, were discovered in the 1970s, it was really a few scientists in the United States and the United Kingdom that were able to use them and understand how to use them. It was much more complicated laboratory work. And so it was easier to get hands around in terms of policy. Now these tools are readily available. They're relatively inexpensive. It doesn't take huge and sophisticated laboratory work to use them. And so there's a scramble, in a good way though, to try to identify what governing principles need to be endorsed as a matter of international policy, because many more laboratories can use these in countries all over the world, some of which are well-meaning and others which may not be so well-meaning, and what to do about them in terms of instituting control. So we just don't have mechanisms by which to control science in ways that we're kind of concerned about or seeing potentially over the horizon. I don't want to be too scary here, because I think it's not imminent, but it's among the conversations that are happening at government levels and scientific academies around the world. It is actually something on people's minds.
Is it analogous to the nuclearization that certain states, you know, we think of North Korea or Iran, which have been in the news about their nuclear ambitions as a state. And then, of course, there are all these non-state entities, terrorist groups, who would love to have nuclear weapons. They probably love to have CRISPR capacity as well.
Well, and they do. I mean, so it doesn't take much to have that capacity. So in some sense, it's sort of much easier and more urgent problem than what it takes to build a nuclear weapon, say. There was actually some evaluation of the sort of weapons of mass destruction potential for use of gene editing and gene drive, and it sort of is being discussed in that way. So it wouldn't take a whole lot of science fiction to actually think about how that could become a real issue. And so again, it's about what can the scientific community do to institute norms and maybe police itself in ways that we don't head down a path like that.
There's just so much more policing that needs to be done now than there was before this kind of technology existed.
That's
right. Yeah, scary stuff. If you want to send us a tweet, at Midday Tom Hall. If you want to send us an email, midday@wypr.org. If you want to give us a call, the number here at Midday, 410-662-8780. Remember, your call may be recorded for training purposes. Let's go to the calls now in Dundalk. Ralph, welcome to Midday.
Oh, welcome back to you and your guests. And we need to get some femme-type people to call in, too, because I'm the third male to call in. And having said that, yeah, I always think of, when I hear of genes, I triangulate it to the DNA and the RNA. And I keep hearing we're going to snip and cut and paste the genes so that it's a permanent thing. Well, wouldn't that kind of like translate into changing the DNA and the RNA support system for everything? I'm just not clear on that.
All right, and I bet a whole bunch of folks, myself included, Ralph, aren't clear on it either. So when you mess with these genes, are you actually changing somebody's DNA?
Yes. The very short answer is yes. So these tools are to modify DNA. That said, I was a part of a hearing the week before Thanksgiving week in the U.S. Senate, in the Senate Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions Committee, where they were asking, they were interested in the use of gene editing tools in humans. And I was there to talk about ethics and policy. There was somebody who is the CEO of a biotech company, and then there was a basic scientist who talked a lot about using new evolving tools that focus not on DNA, but on RNA. So this maybe is a little bit of basic molecular biology, but DNA is the fixed genetic code in every living organism. It is transcribed into RNA, which then is read into, translated is the term, into a protein, amino acids. That in between, so the RNA and the amino acid, the proteins, are transitory, that they go away, right? And they're only created when that DNA is read. And so if you modified RNA, you would actually have not a permanent edit, but an edit in something that was transitory. And that's actually where the science is now headed, so that when we're talking about editing, it needn't be permanent in the way that the caller is rightly identifying. So that was a long way to get there, but hopefully that was a helpful explanation.
All right, it's tough. I mean, I'm taking your word for it here, Jeff, but it reminds me of 10th grade biology when I was probably just as lost then as I may be now.
Yeah.
But it is, you know, these are complicated things, but the enormous implications of, you know, as you say, controlling this, policing this, understanding it, who has access to it. It's really quite something. And there was a piece in the Washington Post, which I don't know if you had a chance to see, and maybe some of our listeners took a look at. I believe it was in last Sunday's paper. And it was an op-ed written by a fellow named Alexander Pyron. He's a professor of biology at GW over in D.C. And he talks about this obsession we seem to have with saving endangered species, because this CRISPR technology, and Professor Esvelt from Harvard was talking about doing that. You get rid of the invasive species, it was weasels or something that were, you know, about to make extinct some other species. So you get rid of the weasels and you keep your species here, your precious species. And he says, you know, we don't need to worry about that, because extinction is the heart of evolution. You know, he says mass extinctions periodically wipe out 95% of all species in one fell swoop. And they happen not frequently, mm-hmm. every 50 million to 100 million years. And most folks figure that we are now in the middle of the sixth such mass extinction. And this one is caused, certainly to some degree, by human intervention, development, and messing up the environment and too many cars and all that stuff. And he says, you know what? It's just part of the deal. Without extinction, you don't evolve. The planet doesn't evolve. A fascinating argument.
Yeah. Well, and maybe one in which you say, well, we throw up our hands and say it's not going to matter much because we're just in one of these periods and everything will start fresh again, right, with a meteor, when the last mass extinction, when the dinosaurs disappeared. But in the meantime, I guess I would say, we have some responsibility to steward the planet and our fellow citizens and the ecosystem in which we find ourselves in the best way we can, right, and the best way we know. And so I think there's probably something to be said about the fact that when humans show up, the numbers of species goes down quite dramatically. That's been true over the course of all human time, so far as the archaeologists and anthropologists can tell us. It feels like there are things that we can do to sort of minimize the damage that we're doing at the moment, and whether it's, you know, making sure that weasels don't crowd out the things that they are in environments where they're invasive, to minimizing human disease by vectors that carry illness, so disease-causing mosquitoes. seems like something we ought to be at least talking about and not saying, well, we're all going to be extinct at some point anyway.
Right. I mean, he says there's no such thing actually as an endangered species except for all species.
Everything is an endangered species.
Including us. I mean, probably not in the next 2 weeks, but, you know, it's an interesting argument because there is this... you know, very keen interest sometimes, and environmentalists get involved in these arguments. I think, you know, for example, I think Mr. Trump was elected in part by people who were incensed that there were regulations having to do with the environment in particular, because now we have Mr. Pruitt dissembling the EPA at an alarming pace, alarms many people. But they're saying that, you know, okay, I'm a farmer in Oregon, or I'm a farmer in Nebraska, and because if I, you know, diverted this water supply or did something to this river or this something to this lake, we would lose some kind of precious frog. And the EPA in administrations past were saying, well, you can't do that because we need the frog. This farmer is saying, you know, come on, I'm trying to run a business here. I'm trying to feed my family. I'm trying to contribute to the economy. Just, there got to be things that matter more than endangered frogs. And, you know, Professor Pyron from GW is basically saying, you know, that getting rid of the frog isn't the end of the world.
Yeah.
If I understand his argument correctly.
Sure. And I guess, you know, to the extent that it's just about one species or two, that may be something. Versus there being the proverbial canary in the coal mine. Clean water and clean air have done more to improve the public's health than pretty much anything you can name. And so backing away from that seems to be a mistake as a matter of just public health, which will probably also have the effect of preserving some species other than humans. So we travel together. Mm-hmm. It isn't just about, you know, frogs versus humans or a particular bird in an endangered habitat versus humans. We're all interconnected in ways that I think arguments like that seem to ignore.
Yeah, it's interesting because he basically also makes the argument that if we're going to worry about a species, let's just worry about Homo sapiens. Let's worry about humans, and the other stuff will take care of itself. He talks about the Everglades. He says, if all of the native reptiles in the Everglades in Florida, there's about 50 of them, if they went extinct, he says that the region would still gain 90 new ones. So on balance, you're 40 up, which it's a fascinating argument.
And who's to say
these 50 are better than those 40?
Sure. Yeah. And I guess I would say, is it that, or is it where the environment is being degraded in a way that not only causes extinction of animal species, but also affects humans?
All right.
That's worth trying to understand.
Yeah, I got plenty more to talk about when we come back from a quick break. Dr. Jeffrey Kahn, he joins us every couple of months to talk about ethical issues. He is the director of the Johns Hopkins Berman Institute of Bioethics. We've got a link to the Berman Institute on our website, wypr.org/midday. 410-662-8780. That's how you can reach our phone lines here at Midday, our email midday@wypr.org, and to follow us on Twitter @MiddayTomHall. By the way, on this Giving Tuesday, we are grateful to everybody who chooses to make a donation to WYPR. Thank you so much for your support. We appreciate it. I'm Tom Hall. We'll be right back.
This is your public radio, 88.1 WYPR.
And welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. If you're just joining us, it's another installment of Midday on Ethics. My guest is Dr. Jeffrey Kahn. He's the director of the Johns Hopkins Berman Institute of Bioethics. He joins us regularly to sift through timely issues in the areas of bioethics and medical ethics. We're talking today about the questions raised by perhaps the unintended consequences of gene editing. So one thing that gene editing does is that it makes possible very personalized treatment for a host of diseases designed for a specific patient with a specific genetic makeup. So it sounds great, but the cost is astronomical, and that raises all sorts of ethical questions about access and fairness in the healthcare system, as if we needed more questions about our healthcare system as we speak. You are welcome to join the conversation, 410-662-8780, our email midday@wipr.org, and to find us on Twitter @MiddayTomHall. Let's take a call. Nick in Baltimore, welcome to the show.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for taking my call. I have to say I'm calling somewhat almost emotionally listening to this conversation play out, where you describe as fascinating an argument that we should just willy-nilly allow our civilization to spiral towards Blade Runner with a massive, completely human-caused mass extinction event occurring on the planet right now. It's not somewhat caused by humanity. It's entirely caused by humanity. And, you know, to say, oh, well, so what if bees go extinct? We're going to have some pretty big problems immediately if a species like bees go extinct and we can no longer grow food to sustain ourselves. So I have to question the motivations of the scientist that you referred to, who says, you know, so what if in a few million years, you know, species will respawn? Who is paying this guy? We all know that the people who profit off of this late-stage capitalism that has completely torn apart the ecosystem of our planet are a very small number of individuals who control the global capital and really don't seem to care very much about the ramifications of their actions and how we treat the world around us, our home. And I frankly would expect both of you guys and your guest to be calling out quite a bit more vehemently just the danger of acquiescing to these bizarro arguments that seem to ignore very blatant realities that we have to deal with and our children will have to deal with. I'll take my response off the air, and I hope you can entertain this comment. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Nick. I appreciate it. It's a persuasive and well-reasoned argument. Again, I'm describing, probably very poorly, an argument made in the Washington Post in the Outlook section. The article is entitled, "We Don't Need to Save Endangered Species. Extinction is Part of Evolution. The only creatures we should go out of our way to protect are Homo sapiens." That's the title of the article, and it's written by R. Alexander Pyron. He's an associate professor of biology at the George Washington University, and so he's making, you know, what is obviously a very controversial, and it was certainly controversial when I read it, which is why I took note of it. He says, you know, at the end of this piece, he says, "Conservation is needed for ourselves and only ourselves. We shouldn't do this. We should do what we do to create a stable, equitable future for the coming billions of people and not for the vanishing northern river shark." You know, he uses that as an example. You know, that's on a very different order of magnitude than bees, as Nick says. But it is quite an interesting notion that, you know, here's a scientist, and you know, Nick, I have no idea who's paying him. All I know is that, according to the Washington Post, he's on the faculty of George Washington University. But, you know, is that the kind of argument that so-called climate deniers are making, Jeff Kahn?
Well,
and I don't mean to, since I don't know Professor Pyron, yeah, and I'm not trying to, you know, paint him with a climate-denying brush.
Yeah. And we're outside of the work that I do as well. It's a very provocative kind of argument. It's why it's on the op-ed page, right? It's not news. It's not a news story. It's somebody's opinion. And so I think it's certainly prompting discussion and argument as we're having here. So that's a good thing. I tend to, in my, you know, educated layperson in this area kind of way, endorse the idea that we're all interconnected. And to say that the only species that matter is the Homo sapiens doesn't really appreciate the fact that we live on a planet with lots of other organisms and we need them. So everything from the microbiome that lives in our gut and on our skin, right, up through plants that we need to eat and to put oxygen into the atmosphere for us to breathe, right, is all interconnected with insects and animals, whether they're surviving or going extinct, and that matters. And so it doesn't seem to me a reasonable argument to say, you know, all we need on the planet are humans. I suppose we could go to Mars and try to live that way, right? That seems to be the future that people thinking about human population on other planets would experience. And is that what we want? I guess is a question I would ask.
Yeah, and he does make the point, and again, I'm not the best person to be defending his argument because, frankly, there's a whole lot of it that I don't buy. But he says, you know, if we have, if what we are doing means fewer, this is how he finishes the piece, if this means fewer dazzling species, fewer unspoiled forests, less untamed wilderness, then so be it. He says.
That's his opinion. You know,
they will return in time. The tree of life will continue branching even if we prune it back. And the question is, how will we live in the meantime? Interesting notion. I've never heard that argument made, actually. So maybe we'll have Professor Pyron on midday sometime.
And I think that last statement is actually an important one to think about from the other perspective. How will we live in the meantime? It's not just, you know, sort of protecting the humans and only worrying about them, but living is more than just breathing and our hearts beating. It's the environment in which we find ourselves and the culture that comes with it and the beauty of nature and clean air and clean water and all of that.
All right, well said. I hear a Kenny G soundtrack behind
you
as you say that on a Hallmark card, Jeff. Very, very touching. No, I'm serious. I'm being jokey, but I think that's very well said. I want to talk about the cost of this gene therapy because, you know, when it comes to access and, you know, who's going to be able to do this, are we going to be, you know, yet again facing this notion of bifurcation in the healthcare system where people who are very wealthy can afford these kinds of therapies that are going to extend their lives for years and years and years, and people who are not wealthy, it's simply not going to be able to do it.
Yeah. Well, and I think it's really an important question about how the healthcare system sustains itself, because as these new therapies start to become available, whether they're gene therapies, as you mentioned, which are kind of individualized for an individual based on their genetic makeup, or very expensive immunotherapies, which are applicable to a small subpopulation, right? Whatever it is, it's a lot of investment to treat a few people. That's the model, and that's the coming model, and it seems to be working very well for the individuals who are able to be treated with these therapies. They are just extremely and will be extremely expensive. And
so there are costs that, you know, estimates that go from $1 to $1.5 million that's per one person.
Yeah. And whether it's a few hundred thousand dollars for an individual course of therapy, or even the drugs like Sovaldi, the hepatitis C drugs, which are, you know, many, many tens of thousands of dollars per patient, $70,000-$80,000 per patient. But the numbers of people who need to be treated are very, very high. It's sort of the volume times the, right, times the cost. These are bank-breaking. And so there's a very important conversation that needs to be had about how the healthcare system can afford to provide these for the individuals who need them. It isn't, I think, about individuals being able to pay for it themselves. That is not sustainable. Nobody can pay $1.5 million out of pocket. I mean,
some people can.
But we should realize that's a tiny, 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 tiny fraction of the population. It's about what kind of a health system do we want, and how do we want to make those life-saving things that are really important available to everybody who needs them. I don't mean just some people, but everybody who needs them. And that's the challenge.
It's the whole scaling up thing, too. I mean, if you have a pill for heartburn, you can make millions of these pills and give it to the hundreds of thousands, perhaps millions of people who suffer from heartburn.
It's a totally different model.
But this is just, the therapy is just for you. I mean, it would work for you, and it wouldn't work for me, and it wouldn't work for
specific about it, it's taking the cells from your body, sending them off to a laboratory where they're modified, and then they're sent back and given to you again. So it's literally a modification of your cells for you to treat the thing that's wrong with you. And that's about as custom as a therapy could be. And on that model, although that's only one of the kinds of approaches that are being undertaken, it will be extremely expensive. It just has to be by its nature. And how will we afford that? I mean, it's an important question. We need to be able to answer it.
How close do you think? I mean, here we have Professor Esvelt at MIT saying we shouldn't be field testing these things, even for stuff like weasels in the forest somewhere. He was a he was the guy who thought that idea up a few years ago, and now he says, whoop, bad idea, and he even published a paper about it saying, this is why I've reconsidered. But how far away are we from field testing, I put in air quotes, on human beings when it comes to this gene drive technology and gene editing?
So gene editing, let's separate the two. So there's an interesting question about the first introduction of some of these gene editing tools in humans. We already do things called gene therapy. We've been doing clinical research in those areas, and some of those therapies are now becoming available, and those are some of the very expensive examples. Those are meant to affect the individual who's being treated, and only that individual. So they won't be modified in a way that modification will be passed on to their future generation. There's also an ability using these tools to modify at the embryo level or even at the sperm and egg level, such that the modification would be passed on to that individual's offspring. What's interesting about that, if we do that the first time, we have to be confident that it's safe to do in a way that's not just about affecting that person, but it's creating that person. We sometimes talk about the first time we do clinical research on an individual human as a first-in-human trial. But some of these techniques would be the first time used to make a human this way, to create a human this way. And we rely in the ethics context on informed consent on the part of the individual to say, I'm willing to be the first. But we can't do that when we're using these tools to make an individual that way. And so what are the ethics frameworks that need to be in place in order to move from the laboratory to animal testing to the first time we do this in a human? That's the conversation that's happening. There's a set of, we can talk about that probably another day, given the hour, but there are lots of conversations going on about what kind of policies need to be in place as we introduce these things for the first time in humans.
And who decides?
FDA. Well, it's part of it. I mean,
yeah,
we have
right now,
policy
the FDA,
answers to that question.
Right, which is interesting. I mean, when it comes to this animal stuff, the FDA has authority over animals that have been engineered with foreign DNA.
Yes.
Because they consider it, regards them as a type of a drug.
Right.
Right? So is the United States Food and Drug Administration going to be the driving force behind this? You know, they have to decide if it's safe and when we could start. Given the current administration's reluctance to accept the science about climate change, for example, you have to wonder the kind of people at all of the agencies in our government concerned with this kind of thing and their receptivity to current science and to the data that's out there. I mean, politics matters, doesn't it?
Politics definitely matters. Although I would say, you know, places like the FDA are made up of thousands of people. Most of them career professionals. They're not political appointees. And so the top level administrator is an appointee, of course, and a number of the deputies. But there are many of the same people there today as were there 2 years ago. And they're still applying the same laws, right, and the same policies in the same ways as they were before. I will say, too, that cases like genetically modified animals fall not just to the FDA for oversight, but the USDA, the U.S. Department of Agriculture. So we've got now combined authority, and that creates both maybe more oversight and sometimes conflicting oversight.
I'm going to give Mary the last word. She sends an email. The danger of mixing genetics and politics isn't new. Eugenics was practiced in the United States in the early part of the 20th century. Siddhartha Mukherjee dedicates his book, The Gene, to Carrie Buck, who died in 1983, not all that long ago. Miss Buck's mother was outside the physical definition of what the ideal American should be. She was declared an imbecile and sterilized as a child. So.
And that's Buck v. Bell, very famous U.S. Supreme Court case, infamous Supreme Court case.
Well, Jeff Kahn, always a pleasure to see you, sir. You give us a lot to think about. We'll see you next time.
Looking forward to it.
Dr. Jeffrey Kahn joins me regularly on Midday to help us make sense of the pressing questions in medical ethics and bioethics. He's the director of the Johns Hopkins Berman Institute of Bioethics. That's it for us today. Coming up tomorrow, a couple of rookie city councilmen, Zeke Cohen and John T. Bullock. We'll get their reflections on their first year in office. Their anniversary is the 8th of December. So that's coming up tomorrow on Midday. We want to thank Joe Squared for providing providing lunch today. Joe Squared serves coal-fired pizzas, risotto, and local craft beers. Locations and hours at joesquared.com. On behalf of the entire Midday team, I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for spending part of your Giving Tuesday afternoon with us, and thanks for your support of WIPR today and throughout the year. We'll see you tomorrow. Have a great day.